The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
There's no concerns with the U.S. economy today. There are few concerns with the U.S. financial markets today. There are some concerns with the global economy today. And there are now grave concerns with the Chinese financial markets today. A proverb comes to mind: prudence, see danger, and take refuge. The simple keep going and suffer for it. Which one are you?
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Last week, Jim Grant talked about how risk is no longer something that people actually worry about. You know, I was thinking about it. Do we really live, Dave, in a world where risk and responsibility have been managed and overpowered with the magic of the central banking system?
It certainly gives us a sense of carefreeness, right? You get to engage the markets without an idea of there being consequence to bad choices. In fact, the more risk averse you are, it's almost like there's
you're out of touch.
Exactly.
You're out of touch if you're risk averse. You know, we have a bull market in everything. And I know we've asked the question, okay, what does a bull market in everything look like if it ever turns into a bear market in everything, when everything is falling at the same time? That'd be something worth looking at, just because we are in this magical time where everything's going up. Even Trump, he criticized the Federal Reserve when it was under a Democratic administration for being too loose, and now he's criticizing it for being too tight.
I sat at dinner this last week with a gentleman who ran the venture capital side of the Harvard Foundation, and venture capital is his deal. As a trained engineer, and we had this fascinating conversation. A part of it did relate to things that are changing. And of course, he's interested in new technologies and innovative shifts within the economy, old economy versus new economy, and where there's opportunity. Obviously, as a personal investor today and in his prior post there at Harvard, part of their foundation group. And part of our conversation revolved around the influence of central banking and how that's distorted asset prices. He was very intrigued by this article from the IMF.
Yeah, the white paper.
And I sent that to him the next morning. He was like, get that to me immediately. There's some guys that I'd really like to discuss it with. But, you know, you look at today, global manufacturing is weak, and the trend of shrinkage in the manufacturing sector here in the U.S. is, and it has been, down for many years. And yes, that's a function of transitioning more and more towards a service economy. And yes, there are improvements in technology, and there's a shift in consumer patterns, which accelerate those trends.
Yeah, but we've got growth. I mean, that's what we're told.
Yeah, on the other hand, if you go to the other end of the spectrum, there's significant growth. And I honestly tend to be a little bit cynical here, comparing the requirements of a manufacturing economy, which, you know, you've got design elements and production elements and marketing and distribution elements. What goes into fabricating a product?
It feels more real, doesn't it, than the technological or service industry?
Well, I can see the jobs. I can see the money created. I can see the money dispersed and then recycled through the economy. Contrast that to 21st century. Century growth, where, like with Google, really we're just talking about a new version of advertising. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I know they're more complex than that, but at least how they started, it's kind of an advertising engine. Or, you know, a digital post-it board for personal moments. It's like online scrapbooking. Facebook.
It feels like it adds productivity, dramatic productivity to the world economy.
Yeah, so online scrapbooking gets a quarterly revenue of almost $17 billion. And I think to myself, yeah, old economy versus new economy, I kind of like the idea of making stuff.
Right. See,
but
right.
Again, I tend to be cynical. Let me set that aside. These companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon, they reported very impressive increases in revenues this past quarter. Second quarter revenue, if you take those three tech giants, came in at a hair below $90 billion combined. And what gives me pause is wondering how many jobs in the old economy would it have required to generate that kind of a quarterly number. So my mind goes all over the place, and you have to forgive my rabbit trails this morning, but I ponder velocity. Why is velocity of money down? Well, part of it is we're moving towards an economy where you don't have an income distribution which gets the middle class the money that they would have had and spending the money they would have had. There's a real interesting shift, and I think the participation there in terms of wealth creation, recirculation, that too is a different dynamic that we may just have to get used to.
Well, wealth is concentrating at the top. I mean, the middle class, they're running out of money much quicker, but the concentration of wealth is up at the high side.
And I guess my point is this, as the economy changes, as the drivers of growth shift, there is a group that benefits. There is a group that does not. There is a concentration of wealth. Part of that, if you're thinking Silicon Valley, this is geographically minded. And it's not the heartland. And here's where I'm fascinated, thinking in a sort of multidisciplinary way. There's political implications to that. That's really my point, is that progress is not bad. Technology is not bad. But there are costs in terms of change and sort of realignment. And some of those costs are not economic.
Well, let's talk about economic because, you know, honestly, economic growth is good for everyone if it's true organic economic growth. But if you really look at it right now, look at the current administration. What they're basically saying is the stock market's doing great. That must mean the economy's doing great. But I want to go into this a little bit later, Dave. It's costing us over $1 trillion a year for it to look great.
Yeah, so you look at his campaign messaging and sort of what you can expect over the next 16 to 18 months as he refines it. And you're right, it's stocks are doing great. Everybody's doing great. We've got a great economy, and there's a conflation, a confusion of economic realities with financial market realities. And I think there is a difference there, and it's worth noting. We would all be doing even better if the Fed would get out of the way. That's what he's kind of hinged on and said, look, you know, GDP growth is great, but it could have been 2 to 3 points better if the Fed would just get out of the way. And I think this is what he's going to find in this election cycle is not everybody is doing great.
Right.
He has narrowed his reference of the quote-unquote economy specifically to the stock market.
Let me ask you that. I mean, we're 15 months away. That's a long time. Is that dangerous that he's looking so closely at the stock market as his measure of success?
I think it's an easy meme to put out there and just kind of take credit for. But it's dangerous politically, given the fickle nature of pricing. And you're right, 15, 16, 18, this is a time frame where I think, given the fickle nature of pricing, it's very dangerous. I think in doing so, he's also forgotten who put him in office. Again, it's kind of the disenfranchised middle. There you've got the gap between those with assets today. Those with assets are appreciating compliments to central bank largesse. Then you've got those with debts living paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
And the irony is it's those that are under pressure economically, those are who don't have as much cushion that came out to support Trump in the last election. And Obama was riding the wave of stock market appreciation post-2009. Here was the issue. The blue-collar world didn't participate, didn't see it, and resonated with Trump's message. How does Trump hit the campaign trail this time and say, you're doing great, look at how much wealth has increased on my watch, when wealth is only increasing where it previously existed?
Well, does he then try to approach a different voter base, the voter base that has the concentration of wealth?
You know, it doesn't matter in a democracy, and it frankly, it's too thin a slice of the pie for that to matter. So where he captured the disenfranchised middle in 2016, and a part of his spiel was Obama was working with a fake economy. Trump was at that point bashing the Fed for boosting Obama's fake economy using low rates.
Right.
And this is again, I step back and think to myself, how do you recognize irrationality in bipartisanship? This is one of the things, because Democrats are so blind with rage. These are a few easy ways of attacking this guy.
Well,
right?
You know how they could attack. They could attack using the retirees. They're voters as well. The retirees have paid for the global financial crisis for the last 10 years. But the zero interest rate policy is still in effect. I mean, Trump is calling for lower interest rates.
You bet. And this is where, again, you could say what changed. Trump was bashing the Democrats working off of a fake economy and low rates, and now he's requiring the Fed to, or at least, you know, verbally doing so, lower rates even further. Bill King observed, similar to you, Kevin, the best way to rile Trump is to ask him, this is Bill's comment, to ask him why it is that he advocates for the appropriation of retirees, the elderly, and the average American's interest income to boost stock prices for the elites. And again, I mean, the Democrats should be all over this, saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, what about the inconsistencies here? And hey, wait a minute, who are you fleecing to whose benefit?
Right, not that they're consistent. It's just that you're talking about how the game is played.
And also, just again, the blindness to strategy and tactics just because they're angry.
Right.
And, you know, Elizabeth Warren's the only one really asking about debt limits and economic challenges, and I'm not a fan. But nevertheless, she's bringing that into the conversation. She's the only one asking about those things. And so this comes back around to politically dangerous moves by Trump. Trump is gambling on the stock market being higher 16 to 18 months from now. And his determination to make that so, to make that happen, comes through in every high-pressure tweet that's sent to the Fed. Lower rates, accommodate, right now.
Something that I've noticed talking to clients, and just, you know, I mean, after 30-some-odd years of talking to people every day on the phone, you can tell when people are saving money, actually coming up with a surplus, or going into a deficit state. I really believe more people are spending principal than actually saving surplus to principal.
Well, and that's where, you know, this last week I was attending an economics conference in Park City, Utah. Great group of people. And I made a simple observation to a couple of the business owners and ladies that we're spending time with. And they appreciated this because they see it as a part of how they operate their own enterprises. Good times are for building surpluses.
Right.
And bad times are for running deficits when absolutely necessary. They agreed. What has happened is that we're celebrating the economic good times right now, but we're not creating margin for the bad times. Where are the surpluses?
Right.
This was the point in conversation with them. The economy is doing well, right? Why are deficits running at $1 trillion annually?
Shouldn't we be having surplus put aside at this point?
Because we're not at war,
yeah,
are we?
Right.
We're not in a recession, are we? Those are the understandable context for deficit spending. So why are we spending close to $1 trillion more than we need to now? And yet, again, we're sort of heralding the good times. Happy days are here again. We should be putting away seed corn and savings and building surpluses. That's the prudent thing to do in good times, assuming that you actually have them.
In the late 1990s, one of the ways that we justified in our minds these incredible stock prices in the tech industry was that the world had changed. You didn't really have to make anything anymore. You really didn't even have to profit. What you had to do was have a really good idea that someday may pay off. I'm wondering if the nature of growth itself, Dave, in our minds has changed from making things and saving and surplus to good ideas and fanciful future fantasies.
There's no doubt that there is a change to the nature of growth, but one of the things that has not shifted through time is human needs. Human needs haven't changed for food, shelter, income. I mean, these are really basic things that we do seek. And so even though we may be fascinated by a growth thematic as investors and prioritize that over income, I think it's important just to recall that human needs haven't changed, even if the nature of growth has changed, as we mentioned earlier. So you've got the winners and losers in the economy, which have shifted, and it's shifted towards services. It's shifted towards tech. The nature of growth, well, frankly, that's also shifted, and it's shifted in favor of credit growth. You look at the post-World War II growth, if you capture that time slice from sort of mid-1940s to the late 1960s, a significant period of economic growth in the United States. And then we went through a slump, a real recession, as we went into the 70s and early 80s. You look at the 80s and 90s. Even in those two decades, there was a greater role for credit to play. It was a period of growth, for sure. But credit played a role as we were doing some deficit spending on the front end, Reagan administration was. And then all of a sudden, we got the peace dividend as the wall came down, the Russians threw in the towel. And all of a sudden, we had this sort of expansion of globalization and major capital controls, which had been in place in many jurisdictions throughout the world. Those came down. So the free flow of not only people, but capital, all these things were opening up in the 90s. But note that in the growth phase, post-World War II, credit was not a big deal. Then in the 80s and 90s, credit played a more significant role. And now it's as if credit is the deal. It is the deal. It's the only thing.
Is there a price to pay if I pull my credit card out and let's say spend $5,000 and call it growth, because in a way, that's how we factor GDP.
Well, so again, GDP figure, it's imperfect. And we had a long conversation, many debates, some of them heated at this economics conference. What does GDP tell us? What does it not tell us? So I would say our GDP figure, as imperfect as it is, factors in a variety of sources of spending, but it disregards whether the spending is credit related. In other words, I see a time arbitrage at work through the use of credit. A time arbitrage in the sense that credit is drawing future consumption into the present, right? So future consumption, you get it now. That's household consumption. That's government deficit spending. That's corporate sector spending. And all you're doing is, in essence, raising the hurdle height for those who are further down the track, right? So for you, it's great. It gives yourself a present tense benefit, you know? So you spend your $5,000 on a credit card, you've got the benefit of, but there is ultimately the payback. And GDP doesn't distinguish the quality of spending. By quality, I mean, is the spending coming from existing capital, from savings, or is it coming from credit? So we have credit as a key component to our economic health today. And without credit growth, this is so critical. And this was not the case in the 80s and 90s. This was not the case in that earlier period of growth, which was more, I mean, again, call it basic nuts and bolts, you know, almost manufacturing driven, certainly post-World War II. Without credit growth, we no longer have economic growth.
Well, and
ponder that.
That is the key, Dave. This is a monster that you have to continue to feed. I think I've told you the story when I was a little kid. I had a Fisher-Price record player, and I think I only had two little records, okay? One of them was a story called The Big Oven, and it was about this man who had the largest oven in town, and everybody loved to see that his house was always warm, you know, and it warmed the whole house and actually even radiated out into the neighborhood. The problem is you always had to feed the big oven. And the way the story ended, and I remember hearing the wind and the cold as a little kid, the way the story ended was he had to tear the house down to feed the big oven. He had to continue, take the walls down, take the furniture. Everything fed the big oven. Credit growth, as accounted to GDP, I mean, or even the stock market, these stock guys are just waiting for the next Fed basis cut.
Well, and again, so we think about a growing economy, and we just had our latest GDP figures and 2.1%. That's great. But when you start looking at the components and say, oh, well, we don't get to that number unless we're using that deficit spending. And in fact, you suck out the government deficit spending consumption by consumers, which is credit-based,
right,
versus from savings. All of a sudden, we're not growing. And that doesn't advertise so
I think
well.
That's called red ink to an accountant, isn't it? I mean,
well,
normally?
Sure. How quickly the markets forget. We've got equity traders who this week are hanging hope on, you know, a 25 to 50 basis point rate cut. So a quarter of a percent to half a percent rate cut this week. The issue of market expectations, that's now in play. So think about this. This is the way I consider it. Doing nothing is a disappointment of expectations. Ergo, the market sell off. Right? That's not an option. Cut by a quarter point. The market believes that's the bare minimum. You get a ho-hum response from the market.
Or you give them a gift.
Or you give them a gift, cut by 50 basis points, and you might see a little positive surprise in the equities market. The currency markets figure out that that's really not good in terms of the contribution to long-term currency stability.
Right.
So the dollar probably sells off, gold does well, right alongside, you know, the stock market, et cetera. So cut by 50 basis points and you see some fireworks. Expectations, that's the point. Your expectations determine whether we as individuals or as a crowd are pleased or disappointed. And this goes far beyond the markets, obviously. But expectations, what you thought was going to occur, what you hoped was going to occur, what didn't occur or what did occur, really how you feel has everything to do with your expectations.
Well, in fragile markets, you do not want to disappoint. You remember when Bernanke was cutting rates and everybody was expecting things to recover and Bear Stearns crashed not long after that.
Well, so the markets forget. What have the markets so quickly forgotten? That when it comes to insurance-oriented rate cuts, which is how that potential 50 basis point or even the 25, which frankly is not supported by the U.S. domestic economic figures. U.S. domestic economic figures look pretty positive. So why we're doing it with, you know, record low unemployment is beyond me. Now, it's not beyond me when you start thinking about the global scale of things and potential weakness within the
global
financial system.
They cannot disappoint anymore.
Yeah, but that insurance rate cuts, what have the market so quickly forgotten? The insurance rate cuts are no promise of smooth sailing. Right. Bernanke implemented rate cuts four times between August 2007 and February 2008.
Before the crash.
Oh, by the way, it wasn't a 25 basis point cut. In total, it was a 225 basis point cut. So, right, you're talking about 2.25% lower, and that was before the Bear Stearns collapse. So much for kind of ensuring that nothing bad happens, getting out in front of it, trying to create this insurance cushion. What did they insure against? What did they prevent? I mean, we're talking about getting today out in front of a global economic weakness with 0.5 percentage point. I mean, really?
Right.
Really? It's worth discussing. It's worth recollecting that when market sentiment diverges from a desired policy-driven outcome, it just does what it wants to do. Markets move, and they're not in control of the Fed. Nothing the Fed implements can stop it when it decides to go.
One of the questions I think we all have, though, is how many arrows does the Fed have in its quiver? You know, reading that IMF paper, ways into the paper, it talked about the poison, being able to stop the poison of people pulling their deposits out of the banking system. So it shows the attitude of the bankers that the money is theirs until you get it back out.
Right, right. Yeah, so that's why a few weeks ago we raised the issue of latitude. I mean, the importance of that paper can't be overstated.
We should reattach it onto the show, so please read the paper.
Yeah, again, because we're talking about the latitude the Fed may have, which has been reserved to this point for the imagination, right? Our imagination. Deeply negative rates.
That's their word. Deeply negative rates.
Exactly. Yeah. Orchestrated through commercial banking entities that we use for keeping savings and checking accounts. And the reference to the IMF paper on negative rates, you may not be accustomed to reading IMF academic explorations or policy prescriptions. I grant you, it's not normal. But this is one that's important to keep in mind. With a market swoon, a market sell-off, you've got the Fed, who has already communicated a hypersensitivity to being proactive. They will be proactive. With rates already at low levels, what does that mean? That they will stretch the limits and will get creative in terms of the tools that they use to address those particular circumstances. And again, we ask the question repeatedly, aren't they almost out of ammunition?
Right.
Yeah, as long as we're dealing with conventional tools, and here they're talking about radically, almost imaginary, choose your own adventure with superhuman powers. I mean, it's almost like, did you ever do any of those choose your own adventure stories growing up?
Sure. Turn to page 63 if you think he turned right.
Now, what if you could actually like also include into that like some superhuman strength where you could actually alter the course of the choose your own adventure by cutting and pasting in your own narrative, and that narrative includes, oh, but I've got Superman's cape. It's almost in essence what they're doing with negative rates. It's like, well, it's choose your own adventure, sure.
Well, but. Yeah, but here's the adventure, okay? And we were told by Carmen Reinhart that this could be coming, and that is create a captive audience. They can do anything they want with us if we're captive.
How many times have we referenced that interview?
It's amazing.
I mean, as we prepare for our commentaries, you and I talk about this all the time. But
right.
the Reinhart interview, you know, she co-wrote the book, This Time It's Different, with Ken Rogoff. She still teaches at Harvard. And if you haven't gone back and listen to that in the archives, it's a must listen, because it basically is a candid exploration of, yeah, when you get into tough spots, the rules change and you don't respect the actors in the same way. That wouldn't have been her language,
but right.
It was basically, as you said, you created a captive audience and assigned losses.
Yeah.
It's always been that way. Why would it be different this time?
So a deeply negative interest rate, let's call it what it is. It's a confiscation of a portion of a person's deposits in the bank.
Yeah, now that's the reality of something which the Fed's likely to implement. Okay, now what's the perception of the crowd? What's the perception by the general public who may not understand what financial repression means, may not understand that by putting rates in a negative territory, nominal negative territory, it's like dealing with a small pickpocket. People don't understand it, so they're not going to worry about it. So really the Fed, what they're doing is they're managing perceptions. And that's the key to management of sentiment in the marketplace, because they cannot be perceived as trapped. They cannot be perceived as cornered or limited in terms of policy responses. That would be a bad thing. So recognize that the man on the street is going to consider, you know, the extraordinary measures that they introduce bizarre, again, we're talking about deeply negative rates, the cost of which they're not going to understand. But I think this is important for you, the listener. You now can anticipate and plan accordingly.
In this area, Dave, here in Colorado, we have a lot of avalanches. In fact, I think I read between here and Silverton, we have more avalanches per whatever it is, per square mile, than anywhere in the country, maybe anywhere in the world. I don't know. They have the Silverton Avalanche School, just so that people can tune their perception of danger. Because, you know, before an avalanche, the snow looks the same as after an avalanche. I mean, the snow does not necessarily tell you that there's going to be an avalanche. I remember you telling the story when you guys were climbing, what was it?
Mount Rainier.
Oh, Rainier. Okay. And you felt, what do they call it, a plate? You actually felt it shift, or you felt it collapse?
Yeah,
just a little bit.
The whole field we were crossing settled. And this was after, you know, 3 days of, you know, 80 to 120 mile an hour winds at the peak of Rainier, where we were locked in the stone structure. I forget if it's Muir Camp or what they call it. But we're locked in there, and people just keep on coming in who are trying to climb the mountain. And, you know, capacity is supposed to be like 25. We ended up with like 70 people in this room. I've never smelled so many dirty socks in my life. It was really amazing.
Maybe too much information, but your perception of the danger at that point led you to basically end what was a pretty expensive adventure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have to know when to hold them, know when to fold them,
right,
know when to walk away. And
yeah,
in this case, we knew when to run.
Yeah.
And so we came off the mountain, had a great ski day, but did not ascend to the top. And a part of that came from the training that we got in Silverton. I was 16 years old when I went to the avalanche training school for search and rescue. And my best friend and I wanted to spend more time in the backcountry and figured we needed the skills. If I was buried, I wanted him to have the skills.
You had trained your perception of danger.
Absolutely. And I, you know, this year is a unique year here in Colorado. We've been through 7-8 years of drought. Drive through the high country here in Colorado, you can see the aftermath of the numerous avalanches that got rolling this winter. 300 to 500% above normal snowfall made for incredible skiing,
mm-hmm,
but it also made for a huge number of avalanches, both in terms of the number and the size. And the San Juan Mountains, as you said, very high concentration of those to begin with. But most striking as you drive around the high country this year is looking at these massive trees that were hit by a wall of snow going 200 to 300 miles per hour.
They were toothpicks.
Snapped like twigs.
Yes.
Snapped like twigs. Yeah. And I thought, you know, I mean, growing up in Colorado as a boy, you know, I always imagined, well, if there's an avalanche, I'll jump behind a big tree. And even if you saw the avalanche coming your way, you could always jump behind a big tree.
Right.
Well, this debris field, many of them that I drove past in the recent weeks, they're equally incredible, because at the bottom of the slope, you've got 50 to 100 foot tall trees, massive trees piled up like giant toothpicks. Because once the avalanche gets running, it doesn't stop till it runs out of energy.
Right.
Typically, that's as it's climbing the other hillside on the other side of a little valley or ravine or whatever, and is no longer, you know, working with gravity, but it's fighting against it, and that's when it stops.
So to use the analogy, I mean, is the Federal Reserve actually trying to keep the snow from breaking?
I think the Fed doesn't believe in hiding behind trees. In the midst of a financial market avalanche, they believe in getting in front of it and through creative and superhuman force, just standing there and holding back the forces of nature expressed through the markets. And, you know, this is again where I think you're going to see them attempt that kind of, with bravado and confidence, deeply negative rates will suffice. This will solve everything. You didn't know we could do it, but it can be done.
Oh, and by the way, you can't take your money out of the bank while we're extracting the deeply negative rates.
Well, and there's something that people won't appreciate, but in the context of panic, maybe people just won't care.
I don't know.
Maybe people just won't care. But here's what no one knows. In 4,000 years of interest rate history, it's never been done.
Right.
Negative,
you know,
nominal
Grant
rates
alluded to that. Interest, yeah, rate observer, author. Grant, last week, he alluded to that. He goes, well, maybe it'll work. But I heard in his voice that no. It's a little bit like saying that gravity has been defied for forever.
Late August, Richard Silla is joining us, Columbia University professor emeritus in economics, and he wrote the book, literally wrote the book on interest rates. Mm. It's about an 800-page book on the history of interest rates, and he would be the first to say 4,000 years of interest rate history, it's never been done. And I might add, perhaps for good reason. But again, what do we know? we know what we know. We don't know what we don't know. And in this case, we don't know how people are going to respond to being in a system which is closed for their benefit. Note, for their benefit, for their benefit.
Okay, but let's go back 10 years, 10 or 12 years. Okay, when the Federal Reserve chairman starts chasing rates down to try to save a crisis, it's a little bit like that avalanche. Sometimes it's too little, too late.
Well, and that's the point. I mean, if we move 50 basis points or 100 basis points or whatever in this environment, again, there's this spectacular failure of memory here from investors and from Wall Street. We talked about the Bernanke insurance cuts, four of them, 225 basis points. No use. Then, and that was before Bear Stearns. Then before Lehman failed, Ben cut rates again to 2% and did a bunch of credit market acrobatics. Do you remember the term auction facility?
Yeah, you know, almost forgot it.
Well, I mean, this was before TARP and TALF and the rest, but you had the term auction facility, which was introduced before Lehman. You had the term securities lending facility. You had the primary dealer credit facility. And these were all in motion before Lehman. They knew that there was issues in the credit markets. They were a big deal. They were exaggerated by derivatives and structured financial products, creating this web of interconnected assets and liabilities. And some of those assets were blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to be proactive.
Yeah.
But nothing they did could have changed the outcomes. And this is, I think, kind of a bottom line takeaway.
Sentiment had changed.
And sentiment is powerful.
Yeah.
It's trending. And it's trending either one direction or the other. And the reality is all they have at a certain point in time is a power to bluff. Sometimes that works. And sometimes I don't know if I'd want to bluff. You know, again, when I was 16 and I heard for the first time that snow travels down the mountain at between 200 and 300 miles per hour, that blew my mind.
Right.
I thought, how can it go faster than a car? How can it faster? And it's gravity, it's momentum, and nothing stands in its way. And that is what happens in markets where sentiment turns negative. Nothing stands in its way.
You know, I remember when I first started taking economics, I took a economics course, microeconomics, and that was how a business needs to run, both in good times and in bad. But it was the small, it was sort of the small picture. It's where you use the microscope. And then there was macroeconomics and money and banking and all the bigger ones where it's more like the telescope than the microscope. In a way, when you're managing money, you really have to have both. You have to have the microscope and the telescope and continually ask the question.
Yeah, well, we do something similar for our portfolio management team twice weekly. The portfolio management team corporately reviews both the macro considerations and the micro company specific portfolio risks and opportunities. And we start with Doug Nolan's analysis of credit spreads. That's, I mean, like clockwork. Mm-hmm. If it's a Monday morning, if it's a Wednesday morning, credit spreads, you know, investment grade bonds, spreads between high yields and treasuries. And then we kind of move through a number of metrics that tell us what's shifting, if anything. Movement in those spreads often indicates a shift in trend, a change
right.
in sentiment, a version of risk off. And we're looking for these indicators within the currency markets and the fixed income markets, which are helpful as early warning signals and as triggers for action that we may take to either employ risk or de-risk our own portfolios. And of note is right now, there's little concern today. Little concern. Very little has changed in terms of credit spreads. Not even, you know, we mentioned a few weeks ago, 70 odd billion euros worth of a bad bank structure being put together for Deutsche Bank. Not even Deutsche Bank CDS, credit default swaps, are pricing in anything that indicates concern.
Right.
At least at present.
Well, it's like walking across the snowfield over and over and over. You know, you and I read a book, a great book called Deep Survival by Gonzalez. And one of the things that he talked about was the reason huge, huge events, survival events occur or death events occur is because a person gets used to doing it over and over and over without consequence. And what we've done over this last 10 or 11 years, we've created no consequence. It's a land of no responsibility, no consequence. Even Grant last week was talking about how it used to be that people would actually pay a premium for security or lower risk. And at this point, there's just no premium in that.
Well, step back from the details and ask whether the compression of spreads on high yield bonds, the difference between what a high yield bond yields and a treasury yield, or look at investment grade debt. I mean, yes, that can be exaggerated by central bank influence. We have that. That's obvious because they've been buying assets in the market. But the additional question is that also amplified by a real complacency with credit risk?
Right. What risk? What are you talking about? We see no failure in the credit markets.
I mean, does it make sense to you, sidestepping if we came to sovereign debt just for a minute, does it make sense to you to see 10-year Greek treasuries yielding 2.05%?
Right.
When the 10-year U.S. Treasury is yielding 2.07%.
When 5 years ago, you and I were talking about whether Greece was even going to survive as an economy. That doesn't make any sense.
Does that register that the Greeks are financing 10-year paper more cheaply than the U.S. is? So again, this issue of complacency with credit risk, yes, there's a central bank footprint. Yes, there is a desire, an implicit belief that the ECB is going to support Greek debt, and so you might as well go there for a higher yield and you'd be safe. It's almost the game that was being played in 2007 and prior, where people said, just buy mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, because at least with the MBS market, it's got the full faith and credit of the U.S. government behind it. Isn't that the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac implicit guarantee? And that's why so many billions and billions of dollars were moving into the MBS market without regard for greater implicit risk. We're doing it all over again.
Well, it's a different form of inflation. You know, we ask ourselves, where's the inflation if we've printed trillions and trillions of dollars to get us out of this financial crisis? It's actually manifesting in an asset bubble. Everything's going up except for the interest that a person can earn in a bank.
And I know we've been harping on this for a long time, but the importance of pricing in the bond market is critical to the pricing of all assets, all equities, real estate, everything. In central banks playing with those yields and thus setting prices in the bond market, that has a knock-on effect. That has a knock-on effect across asset classes. It gives us the bull market and everything. That's the net result. This week, I feel like we've got a little bit of a chorus. Our concerns are echoed this week by the UBS CEO, Union Bank of Switzerland CEO, Sergio Ermotti. He says, I'd be very, very careful about growing the balance sheets of central banks. Of course, he's talking to the ECB because the ECB is getting ready to initiate a new push, right? With the handoff to Lagarde, Mario wants to go out on a high note in terms of accommodating the markets.
Here's some money.
Yeah, and I think the U.S. is in a similar position. Yeah. As in when we have any hiccups within the market, yeah, our balance sheets, the Fed balance sheet will expand. He said, I'd be very, very careful about growing the balance sheets of central banks. We are at risk of creating an asset bubble. Mm. And I would say probably already have one. But that's what he told Bloomberg this week. What Sergio is concerned with is not the creation of a bubble, because bubbles are actually kind of fun. What he's concerned about is how bubbles create destruction when they burst, as they invariably do burst.
Well, and a lot of times these guys want to be on record before it happens. I remember when Greenspan came out, he created a bubble and then he started calling it irrational exuberance. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, wait, you created this bubble. And I remember also, so do you, he stepped away from the Fed before the global financial crisis.
This goes back hundreds
of years. And warned
people.
Yes.
But it goes back hundreds of years because we have phrases like the pot calling the kettle black.
Right.
So, I mean, there is sort of a social norm that people are like, but what about this? And it's like, yeah, but it's your problem too, you know.
The maestro calling the kettle black, yeah.
Well, so with a bubble bursting, collateral damage is a given. And by collateral, I'm figuratively and literally. The unknowns, and this is what really I think keeps central bankers up at night, the unknowns are how that collateral impairment creates overnight insolvency issues with particular financial institutions, which are too big for any entity but the central banks to resolve and get into the mix and help sort out. And resolve is probably not the best vocabulary choice, but, you know, to try to patch up, triage.
I think of the walnut shell game, you know, where you have the P underneath, and the P actually in this particular case would be the bad debt. You know, Deutsche Bank a couple of weeks ago took that P and they shifted it under another walnut, right? The Chinese are doing this. They've got walnuts all over the table and they've got peas all over the table. They're going to actually have more peas than walnuts pretty soon.
I got to spend some time this last week also with a guy who was in a documentary film. He's a really neat guy in his 70s. The movie, documentary film that was made out of his life is called Dealt. And he's what he calls a card mechanic. He could take anybody in Vegas. I mean, he's practiced cards since he was a little boy and lost his sight when he was 9 years old and has such a feel for cards that he knows exactly what's going on in the deck, actually has an interesting visual, I don't even know what it's called, but where he can see things without being sighted.
Really?
Yeah. So it's a bizarre combination of, you know, card trick type. I mean, it's not magic, right? But it, you mentioned the shell game.
Yeah.
And he would say, because he was playing with cards and doing this for me for just a minute, and it, you know, which card is it? You know, like you're playing the shell game. And he said, the reality is, if you're picking a P under a shell, it's not under any three of them. It's never there.
Huh.
And that's the reality, is you think you're dealing with a certain set of factors. No, you're not in control of those factors. And what he wanted to prove over and over again is that he was in control of the deck 100% of the time.
And this is why he was also in control of any surprise that would occur. The surprise is because you can't expect it and you couldn't have predicted it.
Yeah, but see, here, and you can look at 52 cards and say, well, there's only a certain number of variables, and so you're controlling for a controlled universe.
Right.
You're dealing with a controlled universe.
But there's an unknown out there, like you said.
And we've talked about this too with Ken Rogoff. Ken Rogoff is a very bright guy, like his writing, and he's made some very significant economic contributions. But as a grand chess master, he's used to thinking in terms of a set number of squares, a set number of moves, and everything is ultimately solvable.
Right.
Everything is ultimately solvable. What you can't solve is, and this goes back to a famous book, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds.
Right.
Central bankers can't wrap their minds around things that aren't particularly rational or contained within a limited 52-card deck, or I forget how many squares are on a chessboard. But this is where, again, we're dealing with unknowns. We're dealing with sentiment that can be stirred for a variety of reasons. Makes me think of China. Yes, we have prickly relationships with China.
Right.
And prickly is probably important to keep in mind, prickly in the bubble environment we're in, because anything can pop this bubble. If there was ever a credit bubble to talk about, China is it. China is it. In our last portfolio management meeting, I mentioned, you know, Doug leads off with some of the credit market indicators. But one of the topics was the second banking issue to emerge here in 2019 in China. And again, it's like the second significant domino falling. The first was Baoshang Bank immediately taken over. The second is Bank of Jinzhou. It's a small bank, $113 billion bank, small in Chinese terms,
right.
$113 billion in asset bank. No bailout on this one.
Lifting the walnut, there's the P. Okay, no bailout on this one. But the other one, oh, we shifted that.
Yeah, so no bailout on this one, and it's as if the PBOC is trying to establish the ground rules for what's ahead. Remember what happened 2008, 2009? We had our series of shotgun weddings.
Oh, sure.
Financial entities here in the United States. That's happening as we speak in China. Three strategic partners were chosen. I don't know if they volunteered. I think they were chosen to take on a part of the Jinzhou equity. Two so far, right? This is like cockroaches. When you see one, when you see two, there are more that you haven't seen yet.
Okay, I know it wasn't in China, but in a way, Deutsche Bank did the same thing with, what was it, $70 billion worth of debt.
The pressure's on. Pressure's on in the Chinese credit markets. We've already seen cracks within Deutsche Bank, as you mentioned. And this goes a long way to explaining why the Fed is in a dovish mode, because they do not have the data to support the decision they're making this week.
Yeah.
They don't have the data. The data says you should be raising rates or staying flat, because we've got great unemployment numbers and we've got GDP figures which are supportive of growth going forward. What is the data? They said they were going to be data dependent. What data? What data? Why are they being dovish now? What do they see? And I think as we look at, again, the Roche Motel, which is the the Chinese financial system today, the credit markets in China, it goes a long way to explaining why the Fed is in a dovish mode. And it may also explain this mad dash by the investment community into bonds. This was something else that Doug was pounding the table on this week. $254 billion year to date, on track for $455 billion by year end, has flown into the bond market. And that's just to give you some context. Over a 10-year period, you've seen total inflows of $1.7 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
So let that sink in. A 10-year period, $1.7 trillion of inflows into the bond market, and now we've got on track for $455 by year end. That is a massive influx into bonds. Yes, that's yield-hungry investors. They'll take what they can get. Credit quality be damned. Duration risk be damned. Inflation risk. Well, inflation risk is laughable. The central bankers are trying to stoke inflation. Inflation risk is clearly not, if you're looking at the price of bonds, it's clearly not priced into the fixed income markets. Can I go back? Can I go back to Greece for just a minute? Are you telling me that there's not going to be more than 2.05% inflation in Greece of all places?
Yeah, so people are running to safety because if you look at the gold buying, it's the highest in 50 years. We had central bankers buying over 70% more gold last year. I think it was 74% more gold last year than the year before. Somebody knows something.
It's not the man in the street. The man in the street's not buying gold at this point.
The man
in the
street. But the big boys seem to know something.
That's exactly right. So the Fed is concerned. Central banks are allocating to metals. Investors in the know are allocating to safe haven assets.
So I'm going to repeat the question from earlier. When we have a bull market in everything, everything goes up. What's it look like when we have a bear market in everything?
Well, it's a great question. What safe havens in that context have universal appeal? Ordinarily, you'd say treasuries. Yeah. But as Jim Grant pointed out last week, you look at the global government bond market today, and for the first time in history, gold is a high-yielding safe haven asset, relatively speaking.
It's paying greater interest than $13 trillion worth of bonds. That's
amazing?
What he said, yeah.
But there's no concerns with the U.S. economy today.
Yeah.
There are few concerns with the U.S. financial markets today. There are some concerns with the global economy today, and there are now grave concerns with the Chinese financial markets today. A proverb comes to mind, and it's just a bit of ancient wisdom we can end with. Prudence, see danger, and take refuge. The simple keep going and suffer for it. Which one are you?
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.